Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Mary Cummings Jordan. School starts in less than a month for students in the Philadelphia School District. This hour, we'll hear from Superintendent Dr. William Height about what the new school year may look like as in-person classes begin and the Delta variant remains a threat. Then, a conversation with Renee Osubu, director of the short film Dear Philadelphia. It's nominated for an award at the upcoming Black Star Film Festival. But we begin with utility shutoffs across Pennsylvania. More than 116,000 customers have had their gas, electric, or water shut off for non-payment now that the pandemic moratorium on shutoffs has expired. Advocates for low-income families are concerned that for those with big utility bills and limited resources, things are likely to get worse before they get better. Our guest is Elizabeth Marks, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Utility Law Project, which aims to help low-income consumers with all things utility-related. Elizabeth Marks, welcome to the Regional Roundup.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
So put this number, 116,000 shutoffs, into perspective for us. Is that a high number at this point? Is it lower than you might have expected? What are you thinking about that?
So first I have to say any number of terminations, it's important to contextualize that as each number is a Pennsylvania family, and each one is shut off from some of the most basic life-sustaining services, electricity to power your refrigerator, your fans to keep you cool in the summer, your heat to keep you warm in the winter, running water to be able to sanitize, wash your hands, wash your clothes. So we're talking about really basic services, and I would say that every number is too high. But when you're looking at this contextually with 2019 data, the number is lower. And I will say that that is a positive development and not one we expected. But it still is not really cause for celebration. So if I put it another way to you, we have 116,000 households that were terminated in Pennsylvania. And let me be clear, this is just for those utilities that are regulated by the PUC. There are over 1,200 municipal authorities and rural electric cooperatives in the state that are not regulated, and we don't know those numbers. But if you just look at the 2019 data compared to the 2021 data, which is the point of comparison since we didn't have terminations last year, you have 116,000 households when you have about $1 billion in federal aid coming for rental, mortgage, and utility assistance that has yet to reach those in need. So that's the context in which we're dealing with right now.
And so what is the holdup as it relates to the aid? You said that it is not yet available to those who most need it.
So some is through the Emergency Rental Assistance Program, which also provides utility relief to renters across the state. And that has been rolling out for several months. It is a wonderful program capable of paying for debts back to March 2020. It can pay for up to right now 12 months of utility and rental debt. Soon that'll be extended to 18 months with the rollout of the second phase of the ERAP program. But there are challenges, and right now we have a program that's administered by 67 different counties in 67 different ways. And if you can imagine, that has challenges. It's a brand new program, a new delivery infrastructure that didn't exist before, we're hitting some bumps in the road. But that's to be expected with trying to push through that much money in a reasonable way. So, we have some real challenges to overcome. And I think it's taking time as any new program would. And so, I think there's a need for everybody to come together, to breathe a little bit and have a little patience as we get this money out. I think what we do is call on the utilities to be patient, and many of them are. I'm still troubled by the fact that we have 116,000 folks without service with this money available and coming.
Is there a way to measure which areas have the largest concentration of shutoffs?
The utility data right now is not reported that way, but it certainly is something that we have been pushing for, is for more regional data that can tell us at a census block level where these communities are so we can better target. Right now, the data is reported by utility, and that doesn't tell us a whole lot about what areas we need to focus on in outreach and get this assistance out.
Yeah. You mentioned patients just a moment ago, and the moratorium expired April 1, but the utility companies have generally moved slowly, at least from what I've read, when it comes to shutting off service for those who are behind in their bills. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons, but one of them is because there are people that work at the utilities, right? And I don't think, you know, I think I can give my utility colleagues some credit here that they don't want to terminate, and so they are trying to give some leeway. But I do think at the end of the day, they're still going to shut service off if folks aren't paying. And the thing is, many folks can't afford to pay and are waiting for this money to come through. I think the fact that we are allowing terminations to go forward is a problem. If folks, you know, are coming forward and saying they've applied for these funds or are trying to get access to relief, I think some of the utilities have been very willing to postpone terminations, but not all. And some are requiring, you know, proof that that the county has actually committed the funds rather than waiting for that application to work through and kind of postponing once they get notification that there's an application pending. And I think given the backlogs we've been seeing with ERAP and we're likely to see with some of the other programs that will roll out this fall, like the Homeowners Assistance Fund and the Low-Income Household Water Assistance Program, there's going to be backlogs because there's thousands and thousands of customers who are many of them applying for assistance for the first time. We right now have 44,000 applications pending at the end of June for ERAP assistance. So patience is the name of the game. And I think utilities are starting to lose patience. And I would, I just urge them to continue to exercise that patience as we try and get the money out. At the end of the day, if everybody is paid, we can all move on, hopefully collectively, not leaving behind some of our most vulnerable populations.
Yeah. We reported here at WHYY at some point that as of late March, 890,000 accounts were eligible for termination, and that those 890,000 accounts owed a collective $856 billion, which sounds like a pretty strong incentive for utility companies to kind of step up the pressure on customers, at least on those who have some ability to try to catch up on their bills.
Yeah, and I think you've seen that. I mean, when you look at the data, things have gotten better as far as total residential arrears. And part of that is because the funds are rolling out and assistance is making it to folks. The other reason driving some of the numbers that we've seen go down in the total amount of arrears is because folks have entered into long-term payment arrangements that were authorized or required, rather, by the PUC. But this is actually going to, we think, we're a little concerned that it'll have a duality, kind of intersectional issue there, where if folks have entered a payment arrangement and therefore are no longer at risk of termination, at the moment, they've agreed to pay not only their current bill, but also a plus amount for that payment arrangement. And we're really concerned that might be masking some of the problem right now, where folks have gotten into a payment arrangement they maybe can't afford to keep up with. And as folks start to roll off of those, that we're going to have some more trouble. But we have seen a reduction, and I'll say total amount owed is, I looked at these numbers recently. It looks as though residential arrears, they shot way up, about 100% over what they normally are. We're back down to about 40% higher than where they were in 2019, but that's still huge numbers. So, for example, in PECO's service territory, where, in the Philadelphia area, In 2019, June 2019, customers owed about $40 million, and they owe about $67 million now.
Wow.
That's a lot less than what it was a couple of months ago. But again, there's those couple of other temporary short-term protections that are going to start to roll off. So we may see that number go back up again. But it's absolutely right. We got to get that money in. But we do have, you know, like I said, over $1 billion in relief that's available. And, rather than shut people off, have additional expenses incurred, if we can wait till that money gets and reaches those households that are applying, again, 44,000 plus applications pending at the end of June, we may be able to make a bigger dent in that without incurring those other expenses that come along with termination. When you terminate somebody, they lose all the food in their fridge, right? That's the first thing that happens, the food in their fridge and their freezer. So then we're eroding the benefits they may have just gotten through SNAP and other, you know, food assistance. So we're compounding problems. And, you know, bottom line, it's expensive to be poor in Pennsylvania or anywhere, really, because of those kinds of fees.
And Elizabeth, in our last 2 minutes or so here, just along those lines, COVID, as you well know, has magnified existing inequities in so many areas, whether it's health outcomes, education, employment, et cetera. How do you see the expiration of this moratorium as exacerbating those inequities that were already there?
Yeah, well, and you're absolutely right. Even before the pandemic, low-income households, and particularly disproportionately so in communities of color, had much higher energy burdens, which is the percent of your income you pay towards energy. And, you know, I'd challenge everybody to go and do their own energy burden, see what percent of their income they're paying, and then recognize that low-income households pay anywhere between 10 and 30% of their income on energy costs alone. And that doesn't include water. That doesn't include, which can often be over 10% of income as well. And these have had a disproportionate impact on low-income communities and communities of color, a lot because the housing stock in communities with concentrations of poverty and in some communities of color where there's been disinvestment in the households. If you don't have an airtight home, you're likely to use an awful lot more energy. You also may have other problems in the home that may exacerbate energy usage, relying on space heaters, things like that. We really need to be investing as well in long-term solutions that address what's been a problem before the pandemic, but what we recognize through the pandemic, which is that we have this disparity and we need to improve the housing.
Well, Elizabeth Marks, I'm going to stop right there because we have to take a break. Thank you so much for making time to talk with us. Elizabeth Marks is Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Utility Law Project. We appreciate you sharing that information with us. When we come back, what the Philadelphia School District is doing to protect students and teachers when school starts this month.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Mary Cummings Jordan. Classes begin August 31st for Philadelphia Public Schools, and the district says it is all systems go for five-day-a-week in-person classes. With the highly contagious Delta variant still a threat, the school district is taking numerous precautions to keep students, staff, and teachers safe. Joining us with the latest on the school district's COVID safety plan is Philadelphia School Superintendent Dr. William Height. Dr. Height, thank you so much for being with us on Regional Roundup.
It's my pleasure, Tracy. Thank you for having me.
So let me just, before we begin, let our listeners know a way to ask any questions while we have you for this short window of time. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes, or you can call us 888-477-9499. Dr. Height, that said, the 21 and 22 school year will mark the first time in 18 months that everybody's back in the classroom. So for starters, what kinds of changes will students and staff see physically when they enter the buildings?
So thanks for the question, Tracy. And as you indicated, we've been out of school in-person learning for about 18 months. And so for many, it will be the first time they've been in schools in a year and a half. And so individuals can expect several things to be in place once we start school on Tuesday, August 31st. One is that we will continue the requirement for everyone to be masked. We will also implement mandatory testing for all adults, and we will have testing for young people that's done once, if in fact they experience symptoms. We have purification devices in every learning space, in addition to many of the protocols now that we have put in place, like you have to do screener events or screening, pre-screening in order to get into our school buildings. Students who participate in athletics will have to test two times a week, or in extracurricular activities like band and chorus will also test two times a week. And that's called a test to play and a test to participate. And so those will be some of the protocols that will be in place when we return to full person learning on August 31st.
So you mentioned that everyone will be wearing masks, and that means everyone vaccinated or unvaccinated, correct?
That's correct. And so we are following the guidelines of the CDC and the Philadelphia Department of Public Health, which is now recommending that regardless of vaccination status, individuals should be in mask at schools. And so we plan to implement that process, and we'll have everyone that is entering our school building masked.
So, Dr. Hyde, as you know, many colleges and private businesses are now implementing, you know, proof of vaccination requirements. Where is the school district on that possibility? Is that something that we might see at some point?
That is quite the possibility, Tracy, because, as you know, there are different strategies or different protocols for individuals who have been vaccinated if they test positive versus those who have not. So it is likely that that could be something that we begin to implement, where individuals must inform us of their vaccination status. At the very least, individuals who are working within our system. Additionally, young people who are participating in sports, and particularly high school sports, will also have to show proof of a vaccination, and they could do that with a parent. And they would show proof of the vaccination so that they could opt out of the testing that is two times a week.
Gotcha. Yes. Is there any idea at this point what percentage of teachers and staff are currently vaccinated? Do you have any way of knowing that?
We have no way of knowing that because many individuals have been using their own providers to do that. We do know that when the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia helped with the providing vaccines to educators earlier in the spring, we have about 50% of our total staff members take advantage of that. I don't know how many individuals since that period of time have also taken advantage of the vaccines, but we do know that many individuals are also getting the vaccines through their local health providers, maybe their drugstore or other entities that have set up the vaccines.
What about vaccine hesitancy? Is the school district doing anything to address that among, you know, teachers, staff, even students who are old enough and eligible? Obviously, you know, you can't require it yet, but is there any plan to address vaccine hesitancy?
We do, and we have what's called the Philly Student Vax Ambassadors, and this is a wonderful group of young people who have volunteered to both learn more about the fallacies or the untruths about the vaccines, and those individuals are actually going around and communicating with other young people about the importance of the vaccine, the facts about the vaccine, and to encourage those young people to be informed so that they can make a decision. And through that program, which also offers the vaccines, and they've been working with Dr. Ayla Sanford and other institutions that are providing that. We're getting a lot of information to our young people. So we're really thrilled about the Student Vax program, the Student Vax, Philly Student Vax Ambassador Program, who are helping to inform young people. And as you know, Tracy, it really makes a difference when young people are hearing from other young people versus other adults.
Yeah. We have a tweet here from Katie who asks, how can 3 feet of distance be observed with 34 plus students in a class and overcrowding?
Great question, and thanks to the listener for asking that question. The CDC has recommended that where possible, school districts implement the 3 feet distancing. But when it's not possible, that you use the other mitigation strategies like mandatory mask wearing. And so we know there are places, just as the caller tweeted, that where we will not be able to adhere to a 3 foot distancing. However, the CDC has recommended that nonetheless, those young people should wear masks, and masks have been proven to be an effective mitigation strategy.
Are there other physical barriers in the classrooms, Dr. Height? You know, you see sort of these kind of plexiglass or some sort of plastic sometimes around various desks or different kinds of partitions in cafeterias. Will anything like that be available?
We have those partitions and plexiglass spaces in areas where small group instruction are occurring and where the public is accessing, like the offices and individuals in the office. So in public spaces and wherever there is like the opportunity for small group instruction where teachers are very close to young people, we would have those plexiglass partitions, but they've also haven't been a major recommendation of the CDC. And once again, we're coming back to the mitigation strategy that has been most effective, which is the masking and then the testing. And as I indicated before, everyone, vaccinated or not, will be required to mask, and all adults will be tested weekly. And we will also be testing students who display symptoms.
You're listening to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak filling in for Mary Cummings Jordan, and we are speaking with Dr. William Height. He is the superintendent of the Philadelphia School District, talking about the plans that the district has in place for classes which start on August 31st. Everyone will be back 5 days a week. And speaking of that, Dr. Height, do parents have any option of opting out? If they are concerned about the Delta variant, if they're concerned about their children's safety, is that option available to them, or is everybody back 5 days a week?
Thanks for that question, Tracy. Parents will have an option, and we announced last week there will be a digital learning option. It's going to be offered through the school district of Philadelphia's virtual academy. It is 100% independent learning, and individuals can begin enrolling in that program today, and that enrollment period will go through August 13th. One significant distinction, though, is that students who enroll in, we call it PVA for the virtual academy, the K-5 will remain district students, but they will not be enrolled in their current school and will not be receiving instruction from the teachers in their current school. They will, however, be receiving instruction from staff members who are hired to work in the virtual academy. Learning will be 100% asynchronous, so it will be students who are learning on their own, and students will engage in independent learning on their own and using their schedule of learning options through the Philadelphia Virtual Academy. So this is very different than the hybrid model that individuals experienced last spring. This would be a model that is completely different than what's happening in the classrooms at someone's neighborhood school.
And Dr. Height, can you address the challenges that teachers and students will face as they try to make up for learning loss over the past year? I mean, so much class time was virtual for the last school year. There were lots of difficulties, students who didn't have, you know, internet access and so forth. And how are you thinking about addressing the learning loss and sort of getting everybody back on the same page again?
Yeah, so with the American Recovery Act monies, Tracy, we are able to begin addressing some of the interrupted learning. And our goal really is to accelerate learning for those where we have clearly experienced learning loss. And we've begun that process actually this past summer. And this past summer, we had about 20,000 young people enrolled in our summer program. That's more than we've had in probably the last decade. In addition to that, we will have extended opportunities before school and after school, not just to expand learning activities, but for young people to engage in the types of activities that will create enrichment and remedial types of supports for them. Additionally, we naturally need to assess students to figure out where they are, and we'll be working with more individuals in schools that will help provide students with additional supports, not just academic supports, but also social and emotional supports to deal with the tremendous trauma that our young people and, in many cases, our staffs have experienced.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I wanted to ask you about sort of the collective trauma that we've all been through and the mental health issues that, you know, surely follow all of that. And what might that look like in the school district in terms of just sort of addressing the mental health piece of all of this?
Yeah, so we will work with teachers, and we've been working with teachers and administrators. I just left a meeting where we welcomed all administrators back. And we'll be working with all of those individuals who will be participating in what we call healing together, Tracy. And that is really designed around social and emotional supports to help reestablish communities, reestablish some of the routines that are so critically important to our young people, but also allows young people to voice their emotions, their feelings. In addition, we have behavior health counselors who are now assigned to schools. We have social workers who also are assisting in schools. And we've directed more resources to schools that have been impacted by gun violence, that are in communities that are most heavily impacted by gun violence. And so we're putting all of these structures in place, understanding that we have to first reestablish communities, learning communities, before we can begin establishing some of the academic things that need to be in place. And that's what we intend to do, to take time for our young people to share and reflect on the things that have been so critically challenging for them over the past 18 months. And as I indicated, it's equally important for adults.
And Dr. Hyde, as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking about you and your staff and all of the decisions that have had to be made, not just over the last year, but even this summer as you've prepared for all of this. And I wonder if you could just speak to what this process has been like for you, especially since we all sort of thought we were coming out of the woods. Then here comes the Delta variant that now, you know, is a threat all over again. And just if you could talk about what the process has been like for you and the people around you as you've had to make these decisions with a situation that has been very fluid over the last year and a half.
Yeah, I mean, it's been very difficult, and it's nothing that I learned in my educational classes as I was getting my degree to do this work. And it's nothing that any of us have had to experience before. And so one of the things that I think is most important, and when we first started with this, dealing with this virus, Tracy, I said the best way to get through this is together, and really thinking about our ability to be patient, to problem solve, to really think critically about the systems and the processes that we must now ensure that are in place in order to keep young people and adults safe. And so if you haven't learned anything throughout this process, you have learned the ability to be flexible. And we know to the public, you know, that feels like things change, and things change very dramatically. But I want to also ensure the public that those things are changing in order for us to ensure that to the best extent possible, we are keeping young people safe and the adults who support them as safe as we possibly can.
One change that I want to ask you about before we have to say goodbye, and it's not a COVID-related change, is the bell changes that are taking place this year. What will that look like?
That is, thank you for asking about that. And that is a change that we actually started a year ago. And that is, we have a transportation system here in the city of Philadelphia that supports all educational sectors, the charter schools, the district schools, the Catholic schools, and the School District of Philadelphia schools. And Tracy, and for years, there were probably 30 different arrival and dismissal times that we had within the School District of Philadelphia. And when you add on all of those other sectors, there are many more. And understanding that we had to put in mitigation strategies in order to use buses for multiple runs, to sanitize buses between runs, we have gone to a tiered approach. And so schools will be in one of three tiers. And it's not just the School District of Philadelphia, but it's all schools that are using transportation. One tier is 7:30, another tier is 8:15, and another tier is 9 o'clock. And schools can choose to be anywhere within 15 minutes of those three times and still allow buses to make multiple runs. And we're doing that to, once again, make sure that buses can do multiple runs, but also that we can actually clean the buses between runs so that we can also reduce the potential spread for young people who are utilizing their transportation systems.
So finally, Dr. Hite, in our last 30 seconds here, as you've made all these plans and you're preparing, what do you want parents to know as they prepare to send their children back to class? There's probably some apprehension. What would you say to parents to ease their concerns as they head back?
I would encourage parents to try to visit their child's school prior to the school year beginning. Schools will be hosting open houses. Those are intentional so that families can get in and see the protocols and the mitigation strategies that are in place. And I would also suggest that parents also make sure they are prioritizing the in-person learning. And as you indicated, we've been in virtual learning far too long.
Yeah,
children
long
are suffering
time.
As a Dr. result
Hite,
of that.
I'm going to stop you right there. I'm just
understand.
About out of time.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you so much for your help with this. We appreciate it. Radio Times will be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And welcome back to the Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Mary Cummings Jordan. The Black Star Film Festival gets underway in Philadelphia this weekend, and it will showcase more than 80 films by Black, Brown, and Indigenous people from around the world. Now, one of the films that's generating a lot of buzz is a short documentary called Dear Philadelphia. It's a story about fatherhood, forgiveness, and community, and it's set in North Philadelphia. It's also nominated for Best Short Documentary and was one of the breakout films at the 2021 Sundance Film Festival. One of the people prominently featured in the film is community activist Mel Wells, head of One Day at a Time. Now, Mel will be with us in a moment, but joining us now from London is the film's director, Renee Osubu. Renee, welcome to the Regional Roundup and congratulations on the film.
Hey, Tracy. Thanks for having me. It's great to be with you.
Well, so first of all, it is a very long way from London to Lehigh Avenue. What brought you here and sparked your interest in photographing the neighborhood?
Yeah, it's definitely a long way away. I first went to, visited like Pennsylvania, Shanksville, Pennsylvania, actually, a couple of years ago. And I was actually volunteering at a summer program called Camp Hope for Kids. And as part of one of the weeks on the program, I was taking part on an incredible program called Camp Miracles, which works with kids from like inner city Philly. And I just fell in love with the program and decided that I really wanted to return like each year and just kind of build this consistency in the relationships I'd built with these like, you know, young adults or like younger kids, which then turned into a like 5-year long photography project.
And how did you go from being a photographer and taking still shots to deciding to make a film?
I've been working on this photography project for years, and it was just really impacting me, like meeting all of these incredible people and, you know, having the honor to, you know, hear about their stories and photograph them. But what I was realizing was that, you know, their stories weren't always going to translate just through the image. So I decided that I wanted to try out, you know, making my own film, making a documentary where I could, in a way, archive these stories that I was having the honor of, you know, learning about.
So we have a short clip from the very beginning of the documentary. It does a great job of setting the tone, and I'd love for our listeners to hear it. So we'll play that, and then we'll talk some more on the other side.
Some people look at North Philly and they decide in their hearts that negative, bad people, thugs, or whatever might is from North Philly. It's not exactly true. What some people don't realize is some of these people are trying to make it better. It's like two sides to a story.
And so begins the film Dear Philadelphia. It's a film that focuses on three fathers, Josh, Mel, and Dot, and how each of them is trying to make life better for their families and their community. And none of them, Renee, are strangers to adversity either. I mean, what does each of them bring to this film?
Yeah, I think for me, like, I think the biggest thing that connects all of them is just this sense of, I think there's a huge amount of vulnerability that all three of them are willing to give. But ultimately, they've all been through a lot, as they shared during the film. And as you said, like a lot of adversity, but have decided that they want to be, that they want to overcome this. And even through, you know, the relationships that they have with their family or their community, they're just so drawn to bettering themselves. And I think, yeah, they really speak, their lives really speak of, I think, looking forward and really wanting to, with their own experiences, really wanting to help others along the way as well.
And you had your own adversity, Renee, during the time that you were traveling back and forth to Philadelphia. Can you share a little bit about that and how being here helped you through that period?
So I was in Philly back in maybe 2016 when I found out that my dad had been diagnosed with a brain tumor. And at that time, I was actually like running a photography project with some of the kids in North Philly. And I think for me, that was really difficult at that time, just having to navigate those emotions and that huge life change that I was going through. And I think that was a huge part of what motivated me to want to make a film about fatherhood, and especially the Black male experience of fatherhood, and what that looks like. And the complexities of that I don't think is often portrayed in film work.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been talking about the three fathers who are featured in the film. One of them, as you mentioned, is Mel Wells, the president and CEO of One Day at a Time. It's an organization that serves low-income and homeless persons who are battling addiction and HIV/AIDS. Mel Wells is with us on the line. Mel, I want to welcome you to Regional Roundup. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm grateful to be here.
Well, I enjoyed watching you in the film. You are prominently featured. Why was it important for you to participate in a project like this?
Well, it was really important for me to let people know that Philadelphia does some positive stuff. With Renee coming in, that was very important to partner with her, to see another sister or even a Black sister that was trying to come in and do a production. That was awesome. The other fathers that she included, I don't think she understands that she made miracles happen in our lives, because we got to see that God is working and that the light is shining not only on our own family, but there's other people out there watching that we can plant that seed of hope.
Hmm. Mel, your dad, the Reverend Henry T. Wells, started One Day at a Time back in 1982 after his own battles with drug dealing and addiction. And there's this very powerful moment in the film when you share a little bit of your own redemption story, if you will. Can you just briefly share a bit about that and how it kind of informs the work that you do today?
Well, I feel like that God sent me through a storm of my own life where I could not serve the people that I help now that I try to make impact on their lives. I could not do it, you know, if I did not go through my own storm. The people that I serve, they don't want to hear just talk. They want to know that you faced the pain yourself. So I was incarcerated over 6 times, did all types of drugs except heroin. I snorted cocaine, marijuana, pills. I robbed people. I turned into like a nightmare, which you kind of see. We have the highest homicide rate here in the city of Philadelphia. And it was very important for me as I made it through there. Thank God, first of all, to my mom and my dad, who never gave up on me. And when I decided to get out my hog pen and come back home to do the right thing, my mom and dad, the community was waiting on me. It's like, yo, we've been waiting on you. We know who you were the whole time. You just forgot who you were. And now I take that same story to other men across the city and ladies, and we service over 56,000 people to let them know that miracles still happen every day. Mm-hmm. Just look at my life.
You were the prodigal son.
Yeah, that's the truth. I was in the hog pen. Yep, yeah. I was.
Renee, Dear Philadelphia is your first film, and it was featured at Sundance, now at the Black Star Film Festival. Did you have any notion that your very first film would meet with this kind of success?
100% no. I definitely, when I was making this film, it was definitely just more like, I feel like this just needs to be saved somewhere, like to have an archive where these stories could be saved. And I guess my biggest hope for it was that, you know, we could come back to Philly, we could show it, people could come with their families and their friends, and maybe we could do the same thing in London. And obviously the lockdown happened and none of that was possible. So the idea of, you know, entering film festivals was something that I started to consider. And yeah, I entered Sundance, I entered Black Star, but never, ever did I think they would actually accept the film. So yeah, just so grateful to God, the fact that, you know, the film has been reciprocated the way it has been, sorry, accepted the way it has been.
And I read that the film was shot in something like 3 weeks, which sounds like a pretty intense production schedule. I mean, can you talk about the process of gathering all of those stories in such a short time?
Yeah, it was originally meant to be 4 weeks, but then I got chicken pox, so it became 3 weeks.
Oh, no.
It was just a lot of, you know, same with the photography project and the work that I do, just going around, you know, walking around, talking to people, meeting them. A lot of the time was just spent on foot every day, just interacting with people that we would bump into. And obviously people like Mel, who we already had a relationship with, that we could have like sit down interviews that were pre-planned. But literally, I'd say 95% of the people that you see in the documentary are people that we met within those 3 weeks, just from going up and speaking and then being invited into their homes or introduced to their friends and their family.
What was the toughest part for you of doing all of that, putting all of this together?
I think for me, probably the hardest thing has been, probably even more so in post-production, was editing this film, because there were so many people who contributed and were willing to share and spend time, and the fact that it's a short documentary and you can't involve all of those stories, that was probably the hardest part for me. But in terms of actually filming it, genuinely, like, it was, I struggled to think of something that was hard in terms of making it, because it was just a joy just meeting everybody each day.
Mel, I want to come back to you and ask you what it was like for you when you first saw the finished product. What did you think?
To be honest with you, it was way more than just a movie to me, because our documentary, number one, is what God was doing, how far he had brought me and my family and the other brothers that was in the video. But the last conversation, like a real heart to heart, it was like my mother was talking to me, because Renee made sure she sat down and got some information from my mom, because mom knows best. Moms know all of the secrets and everything. And my mom passed away from COVID. And so when Renee, she rolled it out, she was able to send me something that my mom was able to have a conversation with her. And so for me, this was God, a gift from God by using Renee. Renee is like an angel to us here in the city of Philadelphia. And we so much appreciate her all the way from Philly to London. The work that she is doing is not only about film and editing. She is saving people's lives and showing people that it's possible.
And we're so sorry to hear about your mom, but what a beautiful gift, as you described.
Yeah. Thank you, Renee.
Mel, what do you want people to take away from this film when they see it?
Anything is possible. If I did it, you could do it. I dropped out of high school twice, but I just graduated last month with my business science associate's degree. Anything is possible. Whether you're in the horror pen, which we call the crack house, whether you're a guy just gotten a shooting ready to come out, or maybe even lost your own mother or your father, that you must persevere no matter what. And with God on your side, anything is possible. And he will also send support systems like Renee to make sure anything is possible.
Mm-hmm. You know, Mel, there's such a great need, not just in North Philadelphia, across the city, across the country. There are so many people in need, whether they're struggling with addiction, struggling with homelessness, struggling with HIV AIDS, they're dealing with gun violence in their neighborhoods, you name it. And there are people who want to help and feel like it's just, the needs are so great they don't even know where to begin. Mm-hmm. What do you say to somebody who's listening to this conversation who wants to do something that will have a meaningful impact and they have absolutely no idea how to start?
Just help your friends. Help the people that's right around you. It takes all of us as a body to help one person. I run one day at a time and I service over 56,000 people a year. Oh. I could not do nothing without my staff and the body. Sometimes it's just holding a homeless person's hand, sitting down with them and praying with them, letting them know that it's possible. And also, you know, stop sharing just the good things about you. Share the darkness about you. What had made it possible for you to get to the point in your life? Whether you're a mom, whether you're a dad, sister, or brother, there is something in your life, some walk in your life that somebody else is struggling with today, and you are the hope for them to get to the tomorrow from today.
Yeah. Renee, I think that's one of the things that you did so beautifully in the film was to really bring out the vulnerability, the honesty in people about their own experiences.
Mm.
And I'd like you to talk a little bit about that, about how you were able to draw them out and to really, you know, get to those vulnerable moments that, you know, anyone watching can relate to on some level.
Yeah, I think for the most part, I think everybody in some different way has experienced some kind of hardship. But I think obviously, like even as Mel was just sharing, the people within the documentary have really been through it and were willing, as you said, to share vulnerably. And I think sometimes it just comes down to really asking people. I think a lot of people are willing to share their stories, their experiences, but they're just often not even given the time of day to be asked about that. So I think a lot of that was sometimes even just it, was just sitting down and asking people, but also having to be willing to share a part of yourself as well, and not just expecting to take from people, and sharing about your own experiences, and even just the team of people that I worked with as well. You know, everybody having the understanding of why we're making this film, and we're not just going to go into anybody's home and have this expectation of what they're going to give, but have to go with gratitude and compassion in the way that we communicate with people as well.
Hmm. So what do you, Renee, want people to take away from your film?
I think for me, I just really want people to really take away the importance of valuing community and forgiveness. I think, you know, so much, even every time I get the honor to go to ODA and I sit down in one of the group talks, I think so much just, this is a room full of people that are having the opportunity to have a second chance, given the opportunity to try again so that they can better themselves, better their families. And I think everybody just really deserves that. They deserve to have to believe in themselves and to be around others who can believe in them. So that's what I hope that people can take away. Mm. They can start to support others as well.
Yeah. And we'll clarify, ODAD is One Day at a Time. That is Mel Wells' organization. The film is Dear Philadelphia. It is nominated for an award at the Black Star Film Festival this weekend. BlackStarFest.org for more information. Renee Osubu, Mel Wells, thank you both so much for making time to be with us on Regional Roundup.
Thank you, Tracy.
And we want to say a thank you to our producers, Paige Murray Bessler. Debbie Builder is a producer for Radio Times. Our engineer is Al Banks. And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Mary Cummings Jordan. You have been listening to the Radio Times Regional Roundup here on WHYY.